very hard not to do any of the chapters, not to focus on any of the chapters in this book. The chapter that precedes this one is the Living God, and those of you who have been able to read that know the power of that chapter. But we really can't do everything. I will read one thing from the end of the Living God. Everywhere, and it's from page 177. Well, let me read one thing from 175 too, although this is very dangerous to allow yourself to do that. But Christ is the reestablishment of contact. Christ is the reestablishment of contact. Through him, to make contact again with God is to rediscover life, spontaneity, liberty, and our fellow man. Were we not just saying now that good intentions are not enough to heal our depersonalized world? We need redemption, the restoration through Christ of the dialogue. That the contact isn't made, I think Tournier is saying, contact is not made unless it begins, the contact with the world is not made unless it begins with a contact with God through Christ. That's something we might, some may want to take issue with. On 177, about the third full paragraph on that page, everywhere in the Bible we see men thus touched by the divine dialogue, so that they find their true dimension. Their stature increases and bursts the seams of the cramped garment of the personage. We are here at the heart of the problem of the person. We can see why introspection failed. However carefully and candidly a man examines himself today, he will not find what God will awaken in him tomorrow. However carefully and candidly a man examines himself today, he will not find what God will awaken in him tomorrow. That is a promise. It speaks right to Paul, some of what you were saying in the Vespers. It's a promise that I think that, well, it's certainly one that I cling to. The world of things and the world of persons, I think a theme of the last chapter and a theme of this chapter is something that sounds an awful lot like law. But Nancy convinced me that it wasn't. Of course, she could have been just not saying that, but as long as God is an abstract idea, we live in a world of things, of personages. And I think from what I read, as long as God is an abstract idea, we are personages. We have reduced ourselves to things. Why don't I leave it at that and let's talk about this chapter.
John, that line you spoke of, how carefully and candidly a man examines himself tomorrow.
Today.
It would be different.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it seems like he's getting at the point that if we're working, looking inside ourselves to find out answers that won't work, we have to go to each other and to God. But I can apply that sentence to however carefully and candidly we talk to each other or talk to God today, we won't find what God will awaken in us tomorrow.
That's true if we're talking to each other in order to examine, to come up with a definition, an all-inclusive definition of the other person. No matter how candidly I go about doing that, or if you and I are trying to get together and I'm trying to define you, then that does apply to what we're doing. If I'm trying to come up with a definition of you, no matter how candidly I set about to do that, it will not reveal a new birth that may take place tomorrow in you. So it does apply that way, but there are many conversations that we have that are not attempting to that are quite candid, that are not attempting to come up and define the people involved, and so that doesn't throw conversation out the window or dialogue out the window. Sure. Does that make sense, Dawn?
Yeah. Okay.
Land anywhere you want in this chapter for a while. Anywhere you want. That was just a place to start. Look at that second paragraph on that first page, that there are two ways of looking at the world. Two ways of looking at the world. One way is to look at the... There are two worlds, or ways of looking at the world, of entering into relationship with it, depending on the spirit in which we approach it. We may see in it nothing but things, mechanisms, from those of physics to those of biology and even of psychology. Art, philosophy, religion can also become things, collections of concepts, formula, definitions. On the other hand, we can lay oneself open to the world of persons, awaken to the sense of the person. By becoming oneself a person, one discovers other persons round about, and one seeks to establish a personal bond with them. That's right at the bottom of page 196.
I guess I was confused. The person knows the truth too, right?
What's that?
Well, further on in the paragraph, I understand, the ready-made solutions. But it seems that the person would have an understanding of the truth or what he knows to be the truth.
What would be the significant phrase there, difference?
I was trying to look up the distinction.
Is the truth something that anyone possesses? Possesses. I've gone to school for a long time, and I've thought very hard for a long time, much more out of school than I did in school. Do I possess any truth about anything that I've thought about?
No, but you have convictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or
I have.
I mean, it seems that he's making a distinction that I thought was a very fine line.
Uh-huh.
Because he says later, a couple pages later, that you have to speak out your convictions in a way that is truly personal and not theoretical.
Mm-hmm.
I think possessing or claiming the truth, but then how do you? You don't possess it in that it's not boxed up.
Mm-hmm.
But you do. But those convictions are there too. It's a balance. I can feel this. It's got to be a balance. But I don't. I've got no idea of what the.
Mm-hmm.
One
thing he's saying about the personal convictions and speak them out is that we have to value our opinion. So you'll read a phrase in a sentence in Dr. Zhivago where Laura says that the problem of what went wrong in Russia at the revolution was that we lost the respect for opinion, for our own opinions. And then it was just a matter of the state, the revolutionary people offering opinions for them, and then they picked which ones that they wanted to, they liked best. But they lost the value of their own, respect of their own opinion. Now, it's very important to respect your own opinion. And it's like we've spent a good deal of time in rhetoric talking about that fine line that you're talking of now, is that you develop an opinion You forge a conviction. That's his word. And then you seek to be taught by other people. So rather than for me to, like, if you and I are in a discussion on something and we disagree, my attitude is that the truth is somewhere between us. And I strongly hold my opinions because those opinions hopefully are forged ones, ones that I have forged. And hopefully you respect my idea better than I do, and I respect your idea better than you do, and we respect the truth more than anything, and we're trying to come at a more true conviction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it seems like it's awfully hard.
Can you do that without
a teacher or to be a doctor, as you talked about, too, in that, I guess it's always hard.
Because it'd be very easy to develop the claim that you possess the truth. It's a danger that teachers and counselors and doctors and so forth have.
Well, it's a really fine line.
And many times, I think, even though you know you have that, because it is a conviction that has been forged. It sounds like you know, it sounds as if you think that you have the whole truth.
Mm-hmm.
When you know darn well you don't. But it can sound like that. It sounds like that, particularly, I think, to people who have shopped for their opinions. Does that make sense? No?
Nancy says most of the time you get them on sale.
Yeah, that's right. That's on the, he's talking about a different thing there, but that's really something we can talk about too, how well we can go. And this is related very much to what Chris said, is that, what we were mentioning before, is that hopefully we seek out people who have forged opinions that are other than ours. They're the best help we can get in forging our own. See? But if we're really not interested in forging a personal conviction, well, then we get, it's like we did in the 60s, you know? There were, you know, I was with the radicals over here and we were all talking to each other. And then there was, you know, the guys that looked like I look now over there, and they were talking to themselves, you know? And there was sort of the conversation always was seemed scintillating, but it was nothing. There was really nothing of much worth going on except stroking. You know, there was an awful lot of stroking going on. But do you want to talk about that shopping for opinion and forging a personal conviction? When I we were talking about this over the dishes a little bit. When I saw his phrase, you know, to forge a personal conviction, it struck me as something that almost came... I wondered how much, or what we think that means now. Turnier's choice of the word forged was a very good one. And I started asking myself, how much by nature today do we forge personal opinions? Or do we somehow pluck them? Shop for them? Are we actually told that that is the proper way to go about developing your mind?
Like when you're talking about Madison Avenue, no, Quiet talks about a Madison Avenue in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have you think that you should fuck them and shop them. They tell you what, and you're supposed to agree with them. Yes, that's what I want. I want, you know, not to have any body odor. You don't think about it.
Yes. Yeah. They have a intense personal conviction. I stink. I don't mean theologically. We usually use personal conviction and mean ideas or opinions that feel right to me, taste right to me, and support my wants. Those ideas that support what I want to do. Are we a generation that shops for ideas as we shop for groceries? Are we consumers of ideas, opinions, or ideology, or theologies? Do we live our lives inside out? I want to believe X, and then I try to find an argument that justifies X, or an ideology that justifies X. Rather than saying, what is man that thou art mindful of him, and then continuing with that question by asking what is valuable for the life of man. The way to continue that is to ask what is love, freedom, responsibility, justice, and grace, and fear. Or do we instead shop for ideologies that support what we are doing and show us to be already loving, free, responsible, just, graceful, and not motivated by fear? A personal conviction is not a want to that is picked from the ideology tree to justify a present action or attitude. A personal conviction is a sentence that one lives his life under. The interesting conviction is an interesting word to use, isn't it? A personal conviction. A sentence that we live our life under. Isn't that an interesting word? A sentence that one lives his life under. Whatever the momentary feeling shout, and there's again something that you have going into your life and through your life rather than something that has a momentary relevance. A personal conviction is forged. I mean, that word is a really good one, is forged. And that word implies heat and sweat and care and time and strength of grip, of mental grip, and of self and other people too. You need help. You need other people with a strong grip who are also in the process of forging. Then I ask, how many convictions do I have? I want to sort of crawl underneath the table. Or is that a problem that I'm having more than you're having? That I have more than you have? How many convictions? If that's what a personal conviction is, how many do I really have?
Are you done?
Yeah.
Like, when you're talking about convictions, can you also talk about point of view?
Well,
I look at it this way, you know, like the type of attitude.
I think you could have a conviction about the most valuable attitude to have toward life. I think you can have a conviction about that, but I think it's in the realm of what you talk about in rhetoric as an opinion.
As an opinion?
An opinion. And an opinion in rhetoric is something that is the... is not a weak thing. Oh, it's just your opinion. When we say just your opinion, we mean something real dinky. But what an opinion is something that unless someone else comes along and with a better opinion, you'll live and die for that. You know, it's not just anything. It's a very big thing. Are we used to thinking about opinions that way? I don't think we are we? mean, are we in a situation like in revolutionary Russia where we've lost the respect for opinions? I mean, to where that's a valuable thing. And we choose
and we don't resist and we don't try to find alternatives.
Yeah.
We just live that way.
Why?
Well, it's easier.
It's easier. He says something about that in this chapter. It's easier to, you know.
Follow.
Yeah. But what's one of the strange things about convictions? In my life, if I the convictions I have are disagreeable to me, to most of me, the majority of me, John Grauer, is not pleased at John Grauer's convictions. Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not.
Can I ask about that?
In other words, within myself, yes, within myself, a personal conviction is not democratically arrived at. Oh. You see, now that's, see, this is really fun. Just what happened here is so much fun in a conversation. And Keith is a real kick. I mean, he comes from South Dakota. Well, I come from Kansas. But that how in the heck, from two completely different backgrounds, can something be said? That's a miracle. See, are opinions just something? Are they just subjective? Like Keith and I are so much alike. You know, he's writing poems and I'm driving tracks. No, wait a minute. We do have a lot of similarity, but that you can follow someone else's idea. That is always a miracle to me. You know, read Lewis, you know, too, who anticipates your questions and then answers them right the minute you ask them. You say, now wait a minute, in the next sentence, doom, right in the pocket. And you hear that, the pocket, that's a good one, you know, when the ball hits the catcher's mitt, you know, that sentence just, boom, it's great. Well, that's fun when that happens. But, okay, seldom is a conviction agreeable to most of me. Seldom is one of my own personal convictions agreeable to most of me. In other words, the truth of my personal convictions is not democratically arrived at within myself. I don't vote. All the voices within me don't vote, and then I've got my conviction. Well, so what? I mean, is there a so what here? This is talked about in this chapter a great deal, but toward the end of the chapter. First part's about poetry, and the second part's about reason, in a sense. But what about some of these things we've said? Okay. What's loose-ended on that? Is there a specific?
Well,
what does that tell about?
Tells that you're subjective.
Now wait a minute. when I'd say that my personal convictions are not in agreement, most of me is not in agreement, is not pleased by my personal convictions. What is that saying? And about subjective, you can use the word in talking about that. So what does that mean?
Here's what I thought.
Okay.
I was thinking in terms of rational and subjective. That inside you, it wasn't the convictions you held weren't brash when you got out. A lot of them were from feeling, or they were subjective sort of feeling. And that's a hard thing to defend.
Well, that's roughly the reverse of what I meant by what I said. Or at least what I thought I said. What is pleasing to me would be my feelings, usually put in a subjective realm. Now, I can disagree with objective and subjective dichotomies, but let's just use them the way they're normally used. And what pleases me is the one that votes for certain opinions. And to say a personal, and yet I may have a personal conviction, that does not mean a subjective conviction. A subjective opinion is the one that would disagree with, at least in my own case, my personally held convictions. In other words, a personal conviction is something Kierkegaard would talk about as true for me. This idea is true for me. And it isn't just some, you know, when you say it's true for me, you have a height of subjectivity, although that idea is not a bunch of subjective gas. But it's a very, you know, subjectivity is truth.
But one of the things that Kierkegaard says that's course said is that task, he says, is not for us to be subjective, look at ourselves subjectively, but to look objectively towards ourselves and to look subjectively towards others.
Okay.
To empathize with others and to understand, but not to, and to try to see where they're coming from. But that does not mean that one follows one's own feelings. Mm-hmm. One wants to understand where the other person's feelings are.
Yeah. Can you bring that up a little later on the... Later tonight, will you mention that again? Because that hooks in with something he says here. Huh? Well, I'm sure Kierkegaard will come up again. He uses him in here, but quotes him in here at one point. Well, is that a part of my neurosis, or is to be in a situation to where most of me doesn't agree with what I hold to be most true, and those convictions I hope to be sentences that I live my life under, and yet they don't please me, most of me. Yeah.
I have a question about something about following.
Okay.
When you're saying that your conviction that most of you do not agree with your convictions. Now, are your convictions rationally thought out, or are your convictions revealed?
My convictions are I would say in my own case that they are thought out rationally, and they are imagined out, and they are, I try to think with all of me, not just with a rational, see there are two halves of the brain, and there's a rational side and an imaginative side, and I try to use both. But it would be something that I think what you mean by rational, it'd be rationally, something rationally thought out. Yeah.
It would be something, in other words, you're using kind of your heart and your mind.
Yeah, because I hold them with my, you know, I've conceived them with my mind and hold them with my heart.
Okay.
You know?
And are you weighing the assets and liabilities too? I mean, this is just something I'm
assets and liabilities of having that conviction? The assets and liabilities to me of having that conviction?
Well, I guess weighing the good with the bad, I mean are you coming? Oh, let me see.
Why don't you like this conviction you have?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just.
Yeah. But is it related to this? Okay.
Just, it happened yesterday. Did we have that meeting yesterday morning?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, after that meeting yesterday morning, I was just feeling like, I don't want to be a Christian. And I was just really rebelling about, this is too much. I don't want to have to try to live like this. I don't want to have to change this much. And my conviction there was still there. I wasn't denying it, but I was rebelling against having to have this conviction.
Yeah, the conviction is that was so about what my life is and should be.
Uh-huh.
That was there, but...
But the rest of me was arguing it and rebelling against it and taking it. Maybe old Adam and new Adam, or old Eve and new Eve, help in that, but
I'm glad you're no chauvinist.
But Don, does that help? Christ being the offense.
That is what I mean.
That we have to live by something, but we don't want to with most of us. I mean, I know that I have to share some things, but there's still a selfish part of it.
If I don't like you, I don't want to know you're immortal.
But I have to live in that.
You know. If I don't like, say Stuart, if I don't like you, Stuart, I don't want to think that you're a child of God and immortal. I really don't. I'd much rather forget that.
And if I'm mad at you, John.
I'm convinced you are, damn it. You know? You turkey. But does that show there can be the disparity between the conviction and the it isn't pleasing to me.
The thing comes in with forgiveness too. It's mm-hmm. Like if I'm really mad at you, I like to think that I'm the one who has to forgive you, and it's very easy for me to forget that, or to think that you're already forgiven, whether I forgive you or not. I mean, God forgives you,
mm-hmm.
but I like to try to think that I like to be able to nurse that grudge,
yeah.
So that in my good time. I can forgive you. Yeah. You know, so that I'm holding out against my convictions and not letting them have the full play.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not letting them down. They get awfully busy.
Sometimes when we know that God forgives the enemy, we allow that to close the door rather than to open the door. Mm-hmm. And when I know that the other is forgiven, that should open the door. But but I can turn that and say, well, God forgives the bastard. You know, I didn't close the door.
Yeah.
You know?
I can work that way.
Yeah.
But at least the summer was the case with me, and I was going, I was refusing to forgive her, and when I finally realized that God loved her as much as he loved me,
yeah.
I was brought down from my, got pulled out of my self-righteousness. And
yeah.
Because I was in the right.
Yeah.
I was very self-righteous.
Many cases now, that's maybe bringing something else into this, but when you say, I'm in the right, there might be a rightness about your position, but what was right?
Not me internally.
Yeah.
Right in there.
Internally, okay. Was your personage right over against her personage?
Yeah.
But your person over against her person was...
It really blew it.
Yeah. And in a sense that insisting on seeing it as a personage, and you're holding the person down. Now that other guy can be wrong. The other person in the sense of personage can be wrong, and yet their person can be.
It's almost the inverse relationship that almost happens whenever your personage is right over their personage. Their person is normally right over your person.
Ergo.
When I'm arguing something, and if I'm right, then generally, like if I'm externally right, then I'm usually inwardly wrong.
You're self-righteous inwardly,
yeah.
Aren't you?
Uh-huh.
Yep. And if you've managed to show how wrong the other person is, in Turnier's terms, you've put him at the point where he can open up, and new life comes from him, whereas you're sitting there, sitting on top of the well, capping the well. Which?
Which
What you just said.
Just said. Well, I mean, when if I can convince you that you're wrong, and I feel self-righteous about it, and you're convinced that you're wrong, you're put in a sense at the bottom of the cross, knowing you're in the wrong, which is where our health comes from. At that point, that recognition that we weren't what we thought we were. So you are in the good position in terms of new life, where I, if I'm self-righteous, am in the worst position possible. That's in Luther's commentary on Galatians, where he says the chief tool of the devil, self-righteousness, obviously. I mean, it's just obvious to him. He doesn't even think about it. He says this other stuff, this blatant stuff.
John, when that's, you say you're self-righteous, is that your person or your personage?
I think self-righteousness forgets the person totally. In a sense that... I am blind to my person, because a person, I think in Tournier's terms, is a child of the kingdom. Justification and condemnation are not words that child knows. Self-righteousness, that's the language of self-righteousness, is justification and condemnation. That makes sense?
Is that woman in Great Divorce who turned into the grumble, you know, the one who finally, you know, because was she, did she was, there was nothing left but the grumble? You remember that one?
Yeah.
And she, was she a person who had become her personage?
Probably, yeah. So final. That's scary. Is that right, Carol? You know the book better than I do. Yeah. Yeah.
So that we can do that, we can get so locked into self-righteousness that we become that, and the person gets squelched to the point of death.
Yeah. That is the scary thing about the kingdom, when you say that we are more cynical. We're not cynical, but we have, Becker uses the word pessimistic, is not cynical. And he says the Christian, and he doesn't say this except maybe... Have you talked about some other things in the course?
Mm-hmm. I let enough of the letters in.
Okay.
To hold off the wolves.
Okay. Okay. All right. Those personages, to keep the personages at bay.
Yes.
Self-righteous and yet. Excuse us.
Yes.
I forget what I was talking about. Frank's question.
You're talking about pessimists. About
yeah. A Christian. Well, to heck with Becker. But a Christian can say, and he's a Jew, and we all know it. Now, now be sure to read Becker and his letters. You know, to take that comment in. To appreciate that comment as something that is not necessarily anti-Semitic. Not at all anti-Semitic. The Christian has a pessimistic view to the world. Pessimistic view. It says that the person can be lost. It says that, in Dante's terms, there are people who are walking around whose souls are already in hell. I mean, the souls have gone out of the person, and the soul is in hell. They're walking the world. That on the world's terms is horribly pessimistic and makes cynicism look like nothing. And the Christian has that, and that's one of the things that gives immediacy to our lives, too. I mean, that's that sense when I say the front line of the kingdom. We talk about the front line of the kingdom. That, you know, in many moments, I'm either helping you into the kingdom or back into the world ruled by the Prince of Darkness. I mean, there's this sense that we live there. that we're right on the front line. That I'm either stepping into the kingdom or back into the, you know, where it's ruled by Prince of Light, or into the world ruled by the Prince of Darkness. And that's, I'm doing that. My life is like that. It's hard when you have a conception like that to think that you're an insignificant economic unit. So it frustrates how the Christians frustrate the people in Russia an awful lot. I mean, they keep acting as if life matters. And that man is somebody, you know. That's it. Lewis's line that the people that you laugh with, joke with, play with, snub, curse, are immortal. Immortal splendors or immortal horrors. Now the world will say, yes, immortal splendors, I mean, they'll say, well, you were using immortal poetically, and I'll agree with splendors, but horrors, I just don't want to go with. But the Christian ends up having that sense. Now, Frank, your question, which got talked to but missed some of it, can you ask that again? Because it was a really good question. And I know that, but I want the question again. Or have you forgotten it?
I forgot the question that I asked.
Mr. Panasonic. Dita Beard's 18 minutes.
And being in the best position.
Huh?
Being put in the wrong and thereby being put in the best position.
Yes, yeah.
John talked about proving something wrong.
Yeah.
I thought yeah. I had it all upside down. I thought that, you know, that it was like you were cursing the person.
Yeah.
By forcing him into the wrong.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it turns out that if that person has accepted being in the wrong, that's a position of health and strength, because mm-hmm. that's when the help comes in.
Yeah.
You turn it right upside down.
Yeah.
Where Christ did.
Yep, he takes it. In the world's terms, being proven wrong is a very bad thing. In the kingdom terms, and did I talk about world's terms, kingdom terms last time? I mean, well, in that Vespers about justification and condemnation are words of the world, but they are not words in the kingdom. They're not even words of the language of the kingdom, justification and condemnation. They don't even, child of God is not speaking that. When I'm trying to justify myself or my friends or condemn myself or my enemies, I'm doing something. I might say Jesus is Lord, but he isn't. Those words are in the world's terms. Like in the world's terms, Jesus Christ is the greatest loser the world has ever known, you know. A king that dies on the cross. You've got the most incompetent king, folks, that ever lived. You know, really incompetent. You know, and he's a preacher, a really good preacher. He had a congregation of his mother, a prostitute, and a disciple, and probably all three of them didn't really know why they were there. That's how big his congregation was after 3 years of preaching. He owned nothing. He stumbled to the throne. You know, his crown was of thorns. In the world's terms, he's the greatest loser that there ever was. In the kingdom terms, you know, the biggest winner. If in the kingdom we insist upon a word like success, success can look like being on the cross. And in the world's terms, this person who's proven wrong and is convicted of being wrong, is in the best position for growth, new life, intellectually, imaginatively, or whatever it is, spiritually. And the person who's self-righteous, in the right, and convicted of his rightness, is in the worst position in the kingdom, in the best position in the world. See, it's an inversion. You see that kind of thing? In some way, the kingdom is almost the mirror image of the world. It's flipped. Just upside down, almost. The Beatitudes do that, a whole series of those, you know, just a whole series of those. Mm-hmm. Yep. Theologically, 80% of me, in terms of theological convictions, or beliefs about God, my conviction that I'm a son of a bitch and a son of God are both repugnant to 80% of my being. My mother is not a bitch, you know. And it bothers me that that's so. It bothers me so much that I look out and try to find midgets around me that make me feel like I'm bigger. It is just as uncomfortable to be a son of God as it is to be a son of a bitch. Because if I'm a son of God, I'm respected. He can actually say, go and sin no more, and think I can think it's going to happen. He's not pretending. I don't want God to respect me so much. I mean, to command me, as Heschel says. He says, you see, Heschel in Who is Man changes Descartes' I think therefore I am to I am commanded therefore I am. Pascal, I think it was, says that God respects man enough to be a judge. Respects me enough. Huh? Absurd, perhaps. But that sense that with Christ, with that person freed, he actually makes the command. I don't think we can say that when he says, go and sin no more, he's cracking wise, making a joke. Although I can, with a great deal of seriousness and good and clear thinking, what are the two words he uses? Look at my history and say that he's wrong. I cannot know what he's going to reveal tomorrow. And this is how we started the conversation. Something Don brought up. The sense that just because I can look back at my history and say, you're crazy, God. And then saying that, looking back and then say, refusing to live in the promise, rather than living in the promise. I guess I have to really live in that promise. If I don't live in the promise, the next time I sin, I'll shrug my shoulders. Won't I? And when the most important thing in the world is, in terms of rebirth, is to catch myself not being who I am, who I thought I was. You know? And I can somehow say, no, God, I'm going to be humble. I'm not going to be so damn arrogant as to think that you meant what you said when you promised me all you did. I'm not going to be so arrogant. I'm going to be humble. I can't do it. And then I separate myself away from the awareness that is the very awareness that the person, you know, comes through that crack in my heart. Then I'm starting to shrug my shoulders rather than then let the heart open up. It's crazy, you know. But those two personal convictions that I have, I'm not comfortable with.
I mean, gee, if I live there, then my whole life is a movement from uneasiness to uneasiness. Foretelling the future is one of the most horrendous things that you can do. Think that you can foretell the future like that. Isn't it in the Middle Ages that that was one of the great crimes to think that you could foretell? And it was at one period where that was just a plain ugh. But
that
kind of
seems unrealistic to me, or like lying to myself if I say that I'm going to go through this day without sin.
You can't see. Can you see the next minute?
No, but I'm pretty sure it's going
to be. Well, probabilities. Remember what this... Wait a second, before... however carefully and candidly a man examines himself today, he will not find what God will or may awaken in him tomorrow. There's something about the person that looks... Now, if the person is coming through, breaking through my personage, and I'm dealing with you, what do I see? What do I talk to? Do I talk? Do I appeal to your personage? Or do I talk to your person? No matter what you're doing. Might I say something with a great deal of conviction about your person, to your person, that I might not say to your personage with very much conviction?
Yeah. I don't feel like I understand what you're saying.
I mean, I don't know if this is right, but say there's an old Adam and the new Adam, and the old Adam is all this personage and personality and stuff, and the new Adam is the person within. If I'm talking to the new Adam, go say no more. That's no big deal. I'm talking to your person, you turkey.
So the person...
Go say no more.
So the person...
I don't know, but I mean the sense that the person talks to the person. You know?
The person of...
So whether, no matter what you're doing...
Talking to our person.
You can be the drunk in the street... And if I'm open, I mean, if my personage is cracked open, and I know that nothing human is foreign to me, and you're this, you know, I'm the same as you in terms of the same as you in terms of the old Adam and in terms of the new Adam, and I talk to the person within, I can say all sorts of things that sound like promises. Can't I? And pull, in a sense, by talking, addressing myself to the person within, liberate that person to overtake a lot of what's happened in the personage, the outer expression of the creature. Bonhoeffer says something like the Christ in you is bigger than the Christ in me, or that I don't like that, but the Christ in you is Christ is in you and Christ is in me. I think what he means by that phrase is that Christ is not manifested in me. Christ has not freed my person through my personage more than it has yours, and probably yours more in that sense. But isn't there a difference if I relate to you and I see, in a sense, it's crazy in terms of spatial relationships, But if I see through your personage, through your personality, to your person, as my initial act, and then I understand your personality, you know, your personality and your personage and your actions after having seen what's deepest in you, don't I respond to you in a different way?
Yeah.
What can penetrate through the layer of personage and personality? Only the person. You know. All else is bumper cars. You know? You mentioned bumper cars from the Bedazzled the other night?
Yeah.
Besides, but the no touching happened.
How long was that with a conviction, you know, in the first conviction of the teen stuff? Isn't there a sense where if I'm in dialogue with you, which I assume if we were sitting down and have a discussion from there, offering our opinion.
Yeah.
On the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as Christians, hopefully we would be going at it in a Christ-like manner, that is, hopefully the person in me trying to hear the person in you. And it seems to me that the way I see that is going, trying to unravel and work through your opinion to hear the conviction. If that doesn't
keep
come,
going.
Then I've been shopping or you've been shopping. Anyway, it seems to me that once you speak the conviction on which all these various opinions are based,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a meaning of truth. I'm not saying that there wasn't before. I'm not sure if I'm saying it very well. And somehow you speaking your conviction, in a sense, reduces me to silence. For at least 15 seconds. But then I go after your conviction. No. But did you hear what you're saying? What you're just saying? Or am I being totally up here?
No, you're not. You're not. No, you're not. You're not doing that. There are some words, I think, that are being used a little bit off the way I've been using them. Just a little bit off. One thing that Tournier says in this chapter is that it sounds almost like he's denigrating opinion. Maybe it isn't in this chapter. Yeah. It's on page 187. To become a person, to discover the world of persons, to acquire the sense of the person, is to be more interested in people as persons than in their ideas, their party labels, their personage, means a complete revolution and a changing the climate of our lives in order to change, to be more interested in the person than in this other stuff is a change of my whole being an attitude toward everything outside me. But that isn't a cut on ideas and validity of opinion. Because how else can I value your opinion than I know what holds it? And yeah, that if I know that person that you have, and I don't see that a person, an individual cannot have forged a personal conviction without the person being involved in it. I mean, because otherwise they're shot. They've shopped, and you've said that, right? Okay. If I respond, if I know that I have a person within me, and I respond to the person within you, then it is very important what opinions you hold and what opinions I hold, and that those opinions have as much impersonal, which is changing the language, validity as possible. And then that is that truth which is, exists outside of either of us. I'm not pointing at you, your personage and all this stuff. I'm saying my opinion, and I'm pointing, look at this, like that. I'm not arguing with you. That's something that the argumentative mode, if you ever want to communicate, never use the argumentative mode of debate. I've argued, I think, twice in 6 years here. Now, I've been taken to argue many more times than that. But I think I've fielded an argument twice in 6 years. Lost one miserably and the other. No. Still up for grabs. But the sense that we're trying to arrive at the truth that's outside of either of us, and we appeal to the reality outside of either of us to arrive at a better conception of the elephant, so that we that Indian thing about, does everybody know the parable about, or the proverb about the elephant? How many don't? Bango. Okay, Indian, there are seven blind men. They're Indian wise men, and they're all blind. And they go to the elephant. And the question is, what is an elephant? And so the one blind man goes up and touches the elephant's tail. And he says, the elephant is very much like a rope. And another blind man goes up and touches the elephant's leg and says, the elephant is very much like a tree. And another one goes up and touches the side, and the elephant's very much like a wall, and the nose, and very much like a python, and all this kind of thing. Well, anyway, the point is that we have to go around the elephant. We have to go around the elephant, and we need help to do that. And one of the reasons we need help is that you might say, big deal, it didn't hurt the blind man to think the elephant was like a rope. Unless there was a little kid standing by, and the kid said, hey, what's that? Old wise man, he says, it's the elephant. He says, smells it, and he says, that's an elephant. And don't worry, it's very much like a rope. And the elephant steps on the kid. So why should we go around the elephant? We've never been stepped on by an elephant, so big deal. There are lots of little innocent ones around. And that's that sense of using the argument for education shouldn't be placed in for my own good necessarily, but in somebody else's. Because we live in a world where there's kids around and they get stepped on. How did I get to the elephant business? This thing that Nancy is bringing up, that what the elephant really is, it's important for us to know, and we have to touch different parts, And I'm not about attacking you at all, and you're not about attacking me. And we have to, in a sense, separate ourselves from feeling like our opinions are like children, One of the basic problems we have in thinking, reasoning, is that we do defend our opinions as if they are children. And we have to have a respect those opinions and be humble in the holding of that too. But in a sense, I insist that Nancy think. Well, this is exactly what happened outside. I said, you gonna let me get away with that? And you said, yeah, I'll let you get away with anything. And I says, well, hell, you're no friend. Isn't that exactly what we said? Well, what kind of a friend are you? And she was joking, and we were joking. But I says, well, what in the hell kind of friend are you if you're gonna let me get away with anything? What in the hell are you worth? What do you think I'm worth? You think I'm impotent and what I say and do doesn't make any difference? There's kids all over the place. I need your help, damn it, Nancy, you know, and she needs mine, you know, this kind of thing. And now, Edie, Virginia, we don't naturally approach thought that way. Is there any other way to think? There are lots of other ways to feel, but are there any other ways to think? If that isn't happening, are we thinking? No. Because what looks like thought is being driven by feeling. So the boss is feeling. So even though it looks on the surface like thought, it's feeling. You know. So I need, you know, that's a sense of I need people, you know. Well, don't you respect me? You think I'm impotent and it doesn't make a difference what I say? And it isn't going to affect the world. You know, what kind of a friend are you? So, we're not used to thinking about forging. And that idea of conceived by the mind and held by the heart is a good, you know, it has to be more than just a principle. It's got to be held by the heart, because as Lewis talks about in Abolition of Man, he says, you know, you need more than principles to keep you in the trench on the third hour of bombardment. You'll never make it. You'll never stay on the front line of the kingdom if you only have got principles. It's got to be held with the mind and with the heart. And that's called a sentiment, not sentimentality, which is just a fuzzy bunch of stuff. It's a warm fuzzy. But a sentiment, which is held by the mind at its most powerful and the heart at its most passionate. It takes that combination in order to live in the front line of the kingdom, knowing that everything that you meet is a part of your destiny. And that uncomfortable reality of the promise. Yeah.
You were starting to tell about the late lady whose husband was unfaithful to her, and she was jealous and she was mad and made it, and then he came home and she was very angry. But then she starts going to church and he speaks about it better than I do. But anyway, she found the faith and she found conviction for her person, at least it sounded like that. And she was able to forgive her husband and get over those jealousies that she had. But then he was unfaithful again. And she ended up jealous all over again. And she went to Charnier, you know, in desperation because she was doubting her faith. She was saying, you know, well, what difference have my convictions made in my life? You know, how does it work? She was just I don't remember where it is, but I try to find it. But that kind of thing, too, is in living our convictions. I mean, once we form them, and knowing that they're real, but not being surprised or overcome by our feelings.
Well,
he was talking to something there too. It goes back again on the thing that was just going through no more and the whole thing, which was
mm-hmm. Well, the mob of me can overpower, you know, that democratic mob. I mean, the majority of me can overpower the part of me that holds the conviction of this woman. You know, the mob of her can overpower the part of her that holds the conviction and can drag it down. And then she can go back. I think Tournier says, go and ask him for forgiveness. Doesn't he?
I don't remember that. I remember that he said that it was evident that her conviction were sincere, authentic, interested in that she had come to him. That there really was. There was some basis to her conviction. She hadn't just bought into what the church had been saying.
Somewhere else he has, and I almost scream at this point, turn you, you're an ass, you can't do that. You know, this guy has cheated on this lady twice, and now you're asking her to go to him and ask forgiveness, and you're telling her that she can't fake it, that she has got to go to the place in herself, in that relationship, where she needs forgiveness and ask him sincerely for forgiveness. And I says, you're crazy, Ternia. Why in the world did he say that? Because he's some sort of a, you know, Swiss chauvinist? Or does he think that only the person is going to make any difference? Only the person is going to make any difference in what? What he does. I mean, I can have all sorts of ideas, but, I mean, unless my person is involved, all I am is a museum, and you can come and shop. Right? I'm just this store, and you can come and shop, and this guy can make any difference to you. The ideas that I give you, if that's all, if they aren't, if they don't have blood on them, see, they aren't true for me, and the person isn't involved, you're just shopping. Now, the husband's got to go ask the gal for forgiveness. It's the same kind of thing. He's got to do it. It's the only thing that's going to make any difference. Your mob is waiting, you know.
No, but I mean, that's the stuff, right? That can be a little manipulative kind of thing.
That's why he says it's got to be sincere, otherwise don't do it, but go to yourself. You know, go into yourself, go to your relationship. There is so, our lives are so rich. My relationship with Elise is such a rich, if I want to find, I don't even have to go past the last hour, I needed forgiveness. You know, she was with Josh. She said, why don't you go out and smoke a pipe and then, you know, and then come on back in and then have you with Josh? Because I have to go run up and get something for the kids. And I went out there and I was talking with Nancy too long. You know, and she was in here a lot longer than I should have allowed her to be. I need forgiveness for that, in a sense. Not just in a sense, I do. We had a kind of a promise, an implied promise, and I broke it. Well, you don't have to go very far to find something that is really, if you know you're forgiven by God, you don't have to go very far at all to find out 100 reasons why anyone has to forgive you. If you know you're forgiven, you can find those just like that. If you don't know you're forgiven, you're going to find out, when have I ever sinned? You know, it's that old German short story that made such a difference to me. Oh. The image was this guy, there was a bucket that had been in the corner for 40 years, and the water was crystal clear. And he says, my life is like that. And he happened to bump, he never understood what sin was in his life, and he bumped the bucket. Clouds of mud. But the water is clear. The water is clear. I can't see anything bad. Dust just through the years had gone down in there, and it was just muck. And he kicked the bucket in the mud, and then finally he made a connection in his life. In this short story, he had just seen a couple go in after World War II, check into a motel, and he it didn't even bother him. And then he kicked the bucket and saw the mud, and then it bothered him. It didn't bother him. And he realized, no, I haven't actively done anything wrong. like it's muck that thick in the bottom of my spirit, soul, whatever. So I haven't done. But anyway, we don't have, if we know we're forgiven, we don't have to go far. And that sense of the person, even though the wronged one, and you're in a situation that's almost just, it seems like a dead end, if anything is going to make a difference, it's going to be the person that makes a difference. And the thing that, how the person is revealed is in the forgiveness of sin and the need of it. The need of it. That's what, that heart that cracks open and allows the person to come through to the other person. And that's, in a sense, how the other guy sees his face as a person. Isn't it? My goodness, it's almost 10 o'clock. My person is the mirror in which you see your person. Your person is the mirror in which I see my person.
Isn't that maybe what Bonhoeffer's saying, that Christ did it?
That you could, yeah, it's related, that same thing. We gotta stop. We got about a third. There's one sentence.
Why don't we just have it all made?
Oh, we can't do that. I don't wanna. There's one sentence I've got to read you, though.
Can I plant one last thing about the sentence?
Yes, yes.
Because I think we only read the last half, and I think the whole sentence is really neat.
Okay.
That's the one that talks about forging conviction, and I'm on page 10 in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, that's it behooves me, and not others on my behalf, to listen to what God says to me personally. And so to forge for myself as sincerely as I can my own personal convictions. And I found it really interesting to see the connection you made, that by listening to God is the way that you forge. Like I watched Sarah Mass, three blacksmiths, and they stick it in there and they stuck the metal into the fire so the metal became really weak so that they could pop it. And then they had to do it again and again and again, and submitting it.
That's really a good image. That's a really good image. Before God, I get that weakness that allows myself to, my own being to be. Yeah, that is really good. Really good. Man runs away from dialogue for fear of discovering and revealing his person as it really is. This fear is like the fear of the doppelganger meeting yourself in the descent into hell. It may be that meeting yourself, though it is terrible, is a terrible good. If the person is extra-natural, as Tournier says, and we can only meet the person on our knees before God, as he also says, our person may resemble somebody we know, may just be in the image of somebody we know. Well, we've scratched about a tenth of this one chapter. Because in here it says that what's normally talked about when you use the word poet in the best sense of the word, there's a lot of negative senses, but in the best sense of the word, he says that's what God has for everybody. Personal relationship with all people and things, well, and objects. We live in a world of objects as subjects, you know, and that's everybody. And it is not a matter of personality. It is not a matter of environment.
We can have an eye-thou relationship with most things.
Well, language has got us, doesn't it? Anything. Because what he's talking about is, and that was what I was trying to say, the subject business. That we have a personal relationship with everything. And then that's a neat sense, because when you have that kind of relationship, do you put all your hunger for relationship in one person and devour them? That's another whole other subject. Can't do that. But if I love in 360 degrees, will I go about devouring my loves? And that's when we are starving to death, because our life has become so sterile and we haven't responded. That's when we start thinking that love comes just from one person or one relationship, and then we go to them and devour them. But, well, we've got to stop somewhere.